since 1971.
The Freaks, Michigan State University students and other Lansing people, beat the Pigs 12-7 in the second annual Bull Bowl game yesterday, but now have a 2-0 record against the Pigs, who include officers from the state police. The game drew 15,000 persons to Spartan Stadium, netted about $20,000 for children stricken with leukemia.
The home of rock and roll throughout the 70s and into the 80s.
Look at this. More customers. I tell you, without WRIF, Detroit's only real rock and roll radio station, I'd go nuts. Now look at the car I gotta fix. What is it, the only car? Dogs chase it and catch it. Oh, Riff, with the work I do, I need you.
Detroit's only real rock and roll radio station in the decade of the 90s.
With your shot at a Washburn guitar and many other Riff freebies, it's another party exclusive from Hayloft West and WRIF.
For nearly 50 years, we are, have been, and continue to be 101 WRIF.
WRIF 101 FM is Detroit's best, like you've never heard it before.
Welcome to the podcast, The History of WRIF. I am Mike Staff. I had the pleasure of being a Riff DJ for 14 years, from 1992 to 2006. And every DJ, as they're growing up, who wants to be a DJ from a kid, has a DJ that they listen to, that they think is the coolest DJ, that they'd like to emulate. And I'm here with the guy that I always felt that way about, Steve Costan. Great to see you, Steve.
It's great to be here. And you're right, absolutely. All of us have had those guys that kind of pointed the way for us.
Who was yours?
Probably Dan Carlisle was the most. He was on WABX. A lot of people remember him from being the voice on Bob Seger's Live Bullet, which he was the MC that night. And he was really key in the early 70s, around 1970 and stuff and beyond, when I started really getting into the whole FM side. Because a lot of cars didn't come with FM radios back in your parents' car. You had to get that little FM converter and stick it in the glove box. And that was good because it kept you from changing the station a lot, too. But he was key, and he was really out front on stuff, post-Woodstock stuff as well. But, you know, really the MC5 came up on his show once, and, you know, he was cool then. But then when music started changing a little post-Woodstock, probably Bowie and the Spiders from Mars was the first big bang after Woodstock. And, you know, shortly thereafter, Aerosmith and a lot of those Michigan Palace bands, and Dan Carlisle and Mark Pereno and Dennis Frawley over at ABX were probably mine.
You grew up in Redford?
Well, it was in Detroit. No, okay. Everyone confuses that a little bit. For instance, the old Redford Theater is, you know, in Redford. Redford, that part of Redford was its own town until the 1920s, and then it got incorporated into the city of Detroit. Okay. And then Redford Township is separate. That's further out. But so I went to Redford High School in Detroit, Detroit Redford. It was part of the Detroit public school system.
And there was something in the water at Detroit Redford High School, because there's a lot of people that went to that.
Well, the famous one is Ted, of course.
Ted Nugent.
The Nuge went there for a while. From the mean streets of Detroit, which was actually North Rosedale Park, very deluxe, kind of a little mini Grosse Pointe of that side of town. And George C. Scott as well. But, you know, that was, I was in high school when the movie Patton came out. So all the teachers were like, yeah, you know, he actually went here and stuff like that. So there was a little bragging rights going on because that was a big movie when it came out, and I happened to be at the right place.
And there's a couple of other rock DJs, John O'Leary
and Chuck Santoni.
Yeah, that's crazy.
John is a year younger. Chuck's a year older.
Yeah. When did you know you wanted to be in radio, Steve?
Shoot, really not until about 73, 74.
How old were you?
I was 20.
Okay. So you went, you graduated high school, you went to college, you went to Western?
Yeah, I was just screwing around at Lawrence Tech for a couple of years, keeping my parents happy. But the way that the whole radio thing kind of occurred was Bowie was coming to town, and he was still really new. It was 73. Just Ziggy album was the big deal. There was two shows at Masonic, March 1st and 2nd of that year. And back in those days, you had to camp out for the tickets. So I'm going down there in January, and I'm going to go down in the middle of the night and camp out, and it's freezing in January. But I had known Dan Carlisle a little bit. I'd talked to him on the phone, and he said, basically, Mel, you're going for these Bowie tickets. Tell you what, if it gets too cold there and you want to take a break, you can come by the radio station for a while, because I'm on, you know, and you can hang out, get warm and for an hour and come back. And you ever been to the station? I said, no. So we did that. and got to go up on the 33rd floor of the old David Stott building. And, you know, the guy downstairs, you kind of call and come up. So when I got up there, and, you know, we're playing different songs and, you know, kind of having a good time while we were listening to the music late, you know, in the middle of the night. They did have a window that opened right in the air studio for increased ventilation, which sometimes was necessary at that station. I'm not really sure why, but it appeared to be a lot easier than it was. And I was like, hey, maybe I could do that, because I knew a lot about the music. Mm-hmm. But I hadn't. I wasn't one of those guys that wanted to be a radio cat when I was like 14 years old or anything.
Interesting.
Because it was kind of like in the AM days. And, you know, I had my favorite DJs on Keener, Scott Regan, you know, the whole Beatles thing. But, it, you know, then I started thinking, yeah, maybe I can do this. And about 2.5 years later, I did something about it. I wasted a couple more years, and then I decided to, you know, try and get on the radio. And Oakland Community College had a college station. And Carlisle said, basically, just go through the college route, because Spex Howard was brand new then, okay, and it didn't have a track record of producing guys and people that, you know, had been placed and were famous yet, because it was only about a year and a half old. Okay. And $1,300, man, that's twice as much as I paid for my car.
Right.
You know, so so I went that route instead, because it was probably, you know, less serious, easiest path of resistance.
Right.
But it was a good time, because OCC was just about to get their license to go on the actual airways. It was before we just rocked the cafeteria. It was called the Rathskeller, you know. But, you know, you got to run the board upstairs. You don't know where it's going. It's pretty much that same studio
experience.
You're doing
experience. The same thing, sure.
You know, you're in that little room by yourself, and you're trying to make some magic, you know.
So did you get a degree, or?
Well, I graduated from OCC with a community college, a 2-year degree in liberal arts.
Okay.
That's the path of least resistance.
Right.
They didn't really have a broadcasting curriculum. And then I went up to Western, where they did, and took a couple of classes up there, learned how to edit tape and do some stuff. But the main idea was to get on their radio station at Western, because they had a real signal. Mm-hmm. So you could get it in your car, you could get it in these houses and all this. I mean, it was, you know, covering Kalamazoo.
It was real.
So that was cool. It was real radio. And so I did that, and with the object of just, I'm just going to come up here as long as it takes to get a decent tape and get a job and go back to Detroit.
And what was your first job in Detroit?
At ABX.
As a part-timer.
Yeah, we don't screw around. We go right for the...
That's amazing. That doesn't happen very often.
It's, you know, there was a near miss at a country station. My aunt knew somebody at WSDS in Ypsilanti, but that didn't happen. That could have been a completely different career path.
So was it Calvert that hired you?
Yeah, Ken Calvert hired me, and it was for Labor Day of 1977, because the weekend jock, one of them, Mike Mayer, who you know, he wanted the weekend off for Labor Day. I mean, that, you know, talk about a work ethic.
Right, right.
But so that turned out to be a good thing for me. And he said, I can use you this weekend, but I don't have anything permanent. But after I did that weekend, a couple of shifts, he said, you know, the morning news guy does an overnight shift on Saturday. His name was Steve Montkevich. It's really screwing up his sleep schedule. Do you want that overnight shift on Saturday? You know, come in at 1 a.m. I said, yeah, sure.
Heck yeah.
So I started there and just, you know, worked it. Whatever was available, I try and do it. And I kind of did that at Western, too. I took a lot of the overnight ones, because these people were, like, you know, really concerned about their classes and stuff. And so I was doing all this radio. I started missing a bunch of classes. I got put on academic probation and asked to not attend classes for the winter semester, which was great, but I was still enrolled. So then I just took as much radio as I could.
Right.
Because it was like, I don't care about this. There were some guys that had degrees and were still on the college station, and they were working at the record store, and they were like 3 or 4 years older than me, and that was definitely not where I was headed.
Right.
I was a little older than everybody else, too, so I was a little more serious. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're 18, you're kind of goofing off. Even if you get to like 21 years old or something, I mean, you start getting a little more focus, and I got to make something out of this.
How long were you at ABX before you got a full did you get a full-time gig on ABX?
Not at first. No, I was there about 19 months, and they had a bunch of legends. They had Dennis Frawley, they had Karen Civelli, they had Jerry Lubin, and, you know, so they were really stocked with a really talent-rich pool of disc jockeys, and, you know, it wasn't moving. You know, something's got to move. There's only a couple of slots. It's like a basketball team,
right?
You know, only about maybe 5 shifts. And so basically I decided to try and go for W4 because they had guys that we hadn't really heard of that much at that point. It was not really, you know, compared to ABX, they didn't really have any huge stars in
ABX was like it was the first rock radio station, freeform underground. It was super new, super cool FM, right?
Yeah, it was pioneering this new form of radio. And W4 was doing fine, and they had some people come in and out. Carlisle went in and out. I think Calvert and Savelli was there for a while. She was over at ABX by the time I got there. And so it was hard being behind those people.
Yeah, right.
And it was much easier to go, like, nobody knew who Mark McEwen was or really Sky or even Podell. You know, it was kind of, you know, Rick Waldecker, the legend. You know, I mean, good jocks and stuff, but just not the heavy hitters like these guys that I was behind. So I just went over there because I figured I could move up quicker, and it worked.
What years were you at W4?
Just 79. I got there in January of 79. I took the overnight shift, and about 8 weeks later, Sky Daniels left and went to Chicago, and all of a sudden that 6 to 10 slot opened up. And back in 79, that was rocking time, baby.
Yeah,
that
right.
was the best time to be on radio back then. You know,
for sure.
It was people didn't have cable TV yet. We were all younger. Radio was really king, and so that was a great shift to be on.
Right. Well, describe the music scene at that time.
It was really cool because it was kind of getting exciting again. It had gotten a little strange around 77, 76. Some of that softer rock stuff started coming out. Some of the early baby boomers were turning 30, and Steely Dan and Boss Skaggs and the Michael McDonald Doobie Brothers, not the Harley Doobie Brothers that we grew up on with Johnston. And so to me, it sounded kind of wimpy, you know. But at the same time, you had Double Live Gonzo was one of the biggest albums of the year, and that sounded like a battlefield, bombs going off every 2 seconds on that album. And I was more into that stuff just growing up on the MC5 Stooges,
right.
You know, Alice and the Dukes, Amboy Dukes, you know. So it was getting kind of frustrating in that aspect. But then the shot that was needed kind of came in with a lot of the wave bands, you know, like New Wave, you know, they call it punk, whatever. You know, the Knack had the first really big album, but there was other band, the Cars had broken late in 78. And then a whole just army of those bands just started coming out. And it was really exciting in that aspect because it was really a time for musical change. And just by dumb luck, I wasn't really well known before that. And then all of a sudden I'm in this slot. So it's easy to, that's a situation where the past kind of maybe even holds you back a little bit. And hey, man, here's this new thing on the scene and here's the guy that's doing it. So that was just pure luck. But I liked it because it was just more straight. It brought the fun back to the rock and roll instead of, you know, like the Steely Dan and the long jams and stuff was great. But you know, back in those days, I was pretty much impoverished like most people are in their early 20s. I couldn't even lay my hands on that much weed, you know, and I couldn't afford a beanbag chair for crying out loud. So it was a great time. It was really a lot of fun. Things were changing.
Yeah.
And
radio was fun. You had kind of control over what you were playing at the
time.
Well,
everybody did much more in those days. There were still formats and there was bands in there, but you could really shape your show. They had these different categories of songs, but then in each category there was a card file, and you could flip through like maybe 20 songs. I'm going to play this one. Then you could actually see, okay, what would be good after that? How do you actually put a set together? You know, it's not like just random, you know, your show on shuffle.
Right.
You know, there was some rhyme and reason to doing that. And
it was a creative process.
Yeah, and you could actually, you know, if you put together good sets, you kept the listeners longer, you got better ratings. And I was just always raised on that FM radio where we were trying to do that all the time anyways.
Right.
You know, it's really not happening much nowadays, except on maybe satellite or some specialty shows. But,
right.
You know, there would actually, stuff that would actually fit together more than just a collection of the hits. Let's just, you know, swim up in the air and see what happens.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily work well when you do it that way.
For sure.
Even though they're all really strong songs, they just don't say, you know, you don't put a Cadillac fender on a Mustang.
Coming up.
So talk about Calvert. This guy, does he relate to his audience or what?
Oh, yeah. He's the He's everybody's like, you know, favorite frat boy on the radio. I mean, you know, you can kind of hear the penny loafers, you know, when he does his stuff. He was a perfect guy for middays. And then he had that alternate personality, Chuck Roast, and he did the oldies on Sunday mornings on the Electric Brunch. And that was a good, and he could probably still dust that character off and make some hay with it now, you know, playing some of that stuff, because people have kind of moved away from it. And when everybody moves away, it creates an opportunity.
Okay. Yeah, right.
You know, just like what happened during Prohibition. Right. You know, I mean, the same thing. Everything that's ruined, it's a business opportunity.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. It's going to be a busy year for country superstar Jason Aldean. He's extended his Highway Desperado tour and is teaming up with Kid Rock for Rock the Country tour dates. We've ranked our top five Jason Aldean music videos. Text Jason to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Jason to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
Live from the city that believes speed limits are mere suggestions, it's Afternoons on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Legendary personalities from Detroit's iconic WRIF.
This is the home of rock and roll.
Go ahead, tell me more.
With Mike Staff and our special guest, Steve Costan.
How did you get to riff? Tell me about that.
That was kind of interesting. I had gone back to ABX and I was their music director. And what happened was Riff tried to get me out of town. This was a classic ABC thing. They tried to hire me at their station in New York called WPLJ.
Big station.
Yeah, in New York. Big station, big market, Big Apple. You know, big. But my dad had lived in New York City for a while when he was really young, and he just, I told him the amount of money they had offered me, which seemed like a lot, 50 grand back in 1980. But he goes, you just wonder where that money went. He goes, taxes are so high, you have to pay to park your car. You know, and so he kind of scared me out of it. And then when I met with the program director, Larry Berger, I think was the guy's name, at the airport, basically the rock scene was not nearly as big as Detroit. You know, they said the rock stations aren't even, like, dominant like they are in Detroit. Because, you know, New York City's got all this other stuff. They got Broadway. They got this. They got that. You know, see, back then, even John Lennon was still walking around the streets. I mean, when you have that level of heaviosity with in the entertainment biz, DJs aren't near the top.
Sure.
You know, but you got a guy like Arthur Penhall, king, you know, right, in the Motor City.
Yeah, of course.
So I turned the job down. But there was a guy in New York that was doing research for ABC at the time and was aware of this whole thing because he was from Detroit. His name was Fred Jacobs. So Fred knew who I was ahead of time. And the following summer, he was running Riff, and he contacted me, and I moved over to Riff.
History. Yeah. Fred, I found a great quote that Fred had about you. It was extremely cool. It says, I don't ever remember Steve not wanting to do a gig, not wanting to be at an event, or not wanting to go that extra mile to help the station. You can't teach his passion for the music, but all programmers know how valuable it is to have a champion like that on your staff.
Well, you know, how cool is it to be able to get to do that stuff?
Isn't it?
I mean, once in a while, if the schedule gets a little too heavy, you know, you just remind yourself, hey, this is going on. And I got there, and like 2 weeks later, Mark Pasman came up and said, hey, we got this thing. I heard you play a little guitar. You know, we're going to do a thing with the Dick the Bruiser Band, and it's going to this concert that we're going to put on at Pine Knob at the end of the month, and we're going to do like three songs. You want to play rhythm? So you know, so I'm at ABX, and then you know, in September 2nd or something, I'm at a Riff, and at the end of September, I'm on stage playing at a packed house at Pine Knob.
Yeah, it's awesome. That is incredible.
You know, how hard is it to get excited about that?
And that was 1981.
Yeah,
and you got hired in to do what shift at Riff?
6 to 10 at night.
That was the premium.
I was doing afternoons at ABX because I was doing music director at that time as well. But I mean, nobody's going to take afternoon drive at Riff back in, you know, forever, because it was Arthur Penhall all the way.
Yeah.
And rightly so.
Of course. So there was such a great rock scene in Detroit in the 70s, 80s. All these great bands, when you think about it, from going from the MC5 to Nugent, Seeger, Mitch Ryder, The Rationals, Romantics, Adrenaline, Rhythm Corps, like all these bands.
The Rockets. All of a sudden exploded. Now, that was a great moment because 79 was when they really hit it super big. Second album came out. They had Oh Well turn up the radio on it. All of a sudden, the Rockets are playing Pine Knot. They ended up selling it out in August of 79. And Gary Lazar, their manager, had a great idea. He took one jock from each of the three rock stations. And it was O'Leary, Penhallow, and I. And we went up together in a show of unity to introduce the
local
Rockets.
Rock band, yeah.
And, you know, they were selling out Pine Knot, and it actually did sell out. So, you know, there was a good buzz. And you just got to remember, though, the whole thing is like the baby boomers. I mean, I was, you know, still I was in my mid-20s, I think, at that point, maybe 27. And, you know, our generation, unlike our parents' generation, we didn't start having kids right away when we were like 22, 23. I mean, they were just glad to get through the war without getting killed. You know, right, I was like, thank God we're back. You know, it's all over. Whereas as far as growing up, the baby boomers took their time. We were in no hurry to get locked into that stuff. So it was a lot more, they had kids later in life, which had a lot to do. I think it had a lot to do with the taste in cars, too, because the late 70s is when Toyota and a bunch of cars came in. That, you know, we didn't need the big dad's big Mercury with the huge back seats because we didn't have kids, you know. And, you know, we would probably be better off, we were more interested in making them. And so you get a little sports car with a seat that reclined or something. Right. And it tended, so we kind of, perpetuated that, that youth a little bit longer. And we wanted those kind of cars as opposed to, what our parents had because, we were living a different lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. Getting back to the Detroit scene at that time, I don't think there was a city that was humming like Detroit was with a local rock scene, was there?
Well, there probably, don't ask me because I didn't really live anywhere else.
Oh, yeah.
But boy, to be here in the epicenter right then, it was great. And another reflection of that is how good all the rock clubs were doing back then. You know, because we were in our 20s, and like I said, hardly anybody, nobody had kids. So it was kind of just a thing where we went out and saw live bands, like, all the time. And those bands, unlike today, could play those bars and make a decent living.
Right. You know, and play originals at the bars.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They do some originals, some covers, but, I mean, there was a number of clubs. And they did, on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, there was stuff going on all the time.
Yeah. Throw out some of the names of some of those clubs.
Well, near me, there was the West Side Six, which became the Silverbird. Kitty Corner, that's a Six and Telegraph. Kitty Corner was the 24 Karat Club. And there was Studio Lounge, the Token Lounge in Westland. There was a place called Jimmy John's over on 6 Mile. But see, I didn't go to those clubs a ton in the earlier 70s because I had some friends that worked at the Michigan Palace. Mm. And so I could go see these bands, pay a cover charge, and the drinks were expensive, because you're always perpetually broke. It builds character when you're young, so you appreciate it when you get older. But, I could go down and see Kiss and Golden Earring and the Pretty Things and the New York Dolls and Aerosmith and all those Palace bands. And, I went to, Bowie. I think I went to, 4 of those shows when he played there that week because my buddy would just pop me in the side door. So that was a great place to have the run of. That was the exciting thing. The bands were really coming up. Michigan Palace, for folks who don't know, it's kind of like another one of those old theaters, probably bigger than the Fillmore, a little smaller than the Fox.
Mm-hmm. So when you got hired in at Riff in 81, you were doing nights. Arthur was doing afternoons. Mm-hmm. Who was doing middays?
Calvert.
Calvert, and then JJ.
JJ in the morning crew, Ken Calvert, middays. Arthur, myself, 6 to 10. Karen, 10 to 2 at night. Carl Coffey, overnights.
Oh, man, that is
that was the dream team.
That is the dream team.
Yeah.
Tell me about JJ and the Morning Crew. What was it about that show that Detroit resonated with?
Well, he kind of drafted off of Steve Dahl. Dahl was the guy that came in, and mornings were not that big a deal on FM radio in the early 70s because they were trying to move away. That was the alternative to that AM stuff, man. And half of us weren't even up, at 9 o'clock in the morning. What the heck? So he drafted off of that. Dahl became, like, you know, even nationally famous. He went to Chicago, but Johnson was the program director. And so he said, well, I'll just fill in with the character voice guy, George Beyer, the guy who did Dick Bruiser and all that stuff, until we find somebody. I'll just do this for now.
Interesting.
The ratings didn't go down when Dahl left. They kind of, like, stayed and built when Johnson was in there. And he just decided that rather than have the program director, you know, responsibilities, and those guys get fired a lot too and stuff, maybe I can make hay as this morning show talent. And boy, he did a good job. And they were just so dominant. And they just jumped on the whole disco demolition thing from here in Detroit.
What that, Steve Dahl was doing in Chicago.
Yeah, he started, you know, Dahl was here. It hadn't really built up too much in Detroit when he was here in town, but it really came to a head when he went to Chicago in 79. And of course, that big demolition, which happened to be against the Tigers.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was a Tiger game.
Funny, I didn't
know
that.
So it was on TV, yeah.
That's awesome.
We watched it as it was happening because the White Sox played the Tigers that night.
That is awesome.
And the Tigers got a win.
Right.
Because the White Sox had to forfeit. Very similar to the only way we get wins, like, here in these days.
It's hard to talk about it right now.
Yeah, moving on. So that's how that worked out.
So talk about Calvert. This guy, does he relate to his audience or what?
Oh, yeah. He's the... he's everybody's like, you know, favorite frat boy on the radio. You know, I've worked with guys who are a little more rock enthusiasts when it comes to the heavier rock and stuff. But, you know, Ken's a little older than I am. And, you know, I mean, you know, you can kind of hear the penny loafers, you know, when he does his stuff. And he was a perfect guy for middays. And then he had that alternate personality, Chuck Roast, and he did the oldies on Sunday mornings on the Electric Brunch. And that was a good, and he could probably still dust that character off and make some hay with it now, you know, playing some of that stuff, because people have kind of moved away from it. And when everybody moves away, it creates an opportunity.
Yeah, right.
You know, just like what happened during Prohibition. Right. You know, I mean, the same thing. Everything that's ruined, it's a business opportunity.
Right. So. How about Arthur P.? Talk about Art.
Now, that was kind of strange, because when I first got into radio and stuff, you know, he was the big kahuna and stuff, but stylistically, he wasn't the guy that I was getting my cues from. But, you know, I mentioned the other guys that I was into.
Yeah.
You know, he was a little more of a boss jock thing, but when I got to meet the guy, he was really great. He's got a very gruff exterior, but underneath there's a whole different Arthur. And he really took me under his wing. And the fact that, you know, he was out kind of staying out late, and I'd get off at 10, he'd be somewhere, maybe the center stage or this or that. So I you know, being the new guy, he invited me and kind of initiated me a little bit. And that was
initiation.
Really key. Yeah, exactly. Hanging around with this guy, because he's got about 10 years on me, but all this wealth of experience and knowledge. And when you're just starting off, it's really cool to hang around with the old guys and just kind of be quiet and soak it in.
How about Karen Savelli?
Well, she was the first one on the radio. There was some other women on the radio before, but nothing like the impact that Karen had. And I didn't listen to W4 that much. I think I caught her like once or twice late. She was on late night. This used to be like the Poor People's Concert. It was basically a concert replay after a big show in town.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember catching some of that. And by the late 70s, the other women who were on the radio on ABX, I can't remember even some of their names, had kind of faded away, but she had kind of stuck around and become, you know, bigger. Mm-hmm. And she's got a really good feel for rock and roll, too.
She does. You know,
which is important, because not everybody does. I mean, and I have a certain feel for a certain type of rock, and it's more harder and more, you know, irrational exuberance that is Detroit rock. And, you know, the big personality bands seem to... and you know what? A lot of those bands are still successful today, because they had these guys that could not sit down and behave. You know, they had Iggy, they had Alice Cooper, they had Ted Nugent swinging from the loincloth, you know. And so they always brought a show, and it was really good. And it kind of reinforces my mantra that rock and roll is better than music.
Right. That's a great line.
Now, actually, it's not original. There was a music store in Ann Arbor that had that on a T-shirt.
I was going to say that.
That's a keeper.
That'd be a great T-shirt.
Yeah, I think it was called Al Nally Music. I want to give credit where credit's due.
There's something more to that, though, too. It's... it's an attitude. Is what
exactly. Yeah. Totally. Yeah. And it was, you know, 18 and just, you know, going wild a little bit, and it was just the wilder, more extreme side of rock. But boy, was it entertaining.
Right.
You know,
who gave you the moniker Kid costume?
Arthur.
Arthur did that.
You know, and I didn't want it because I knew that, I was 27, and I think when I hired in there, and I knew that was not going to be long for the world, and it didn't seem like it had a long-term, validity to it. But the thing about it with Arthur is if he starts needling you on something, and then you say, hey, man, like, don't do that, he's going to do it twice as much.
I learned that.
You know, and that's when I learned that one, too. So, welcome to the club.
Right, exactly. In 81 that Wheels came on the air?
They came out in 1980.
Okay.
And what happened was when they came out in the August of 80, Riff was just, killing everybody. And I was at ABX, and we were getting killed by Riff. Then Wheels came on, and they were commercial free, but they weren't even playing the Jay Giles band, and somehow they still managed to beat Riff because they had that commercial free period in there. But that really shook things up, and that's when Tom Bender left Riff, and Fred Jacobs came in earlier the next year because Riff, ABC doesn't like being a runner-up, so they will do whatever, you just call them, they'll send in another, New York, send me another bushel of cash for buying a TV schedule. Remember when radio stations actually advertise on television?
Sure.
And having Channel 7 right across the driveway in the same complex.
Owning
there.
The same,
yeah,
same radio
they were both
station,
owned and operated by ABC. We'd always had TV campaigns. I mean, we had the real Dick the Bruiser one year.
Right.
In a Riff commercial. And then Rodney Dangerfield was in it one year.
I remember that.
We had the heavy hitter stuff, It was really kind of cool and special to, and the Kelly Harmon Talking Mouth was famous. That came out in 79. It had a huge impact. They recut it in 81 and they put me in that one. But for some reason, if you go look for YouTube, they can find the original. The second one that ran in 81, 82 doesn't seem to come up as often.
Not as often, but they still, I still
you have
comes
seen
up.
It?
Yeah,
okay.
I saw it recently.
All right, good. That's good to know.
And then, of course, Riff did that later with Karen Newman.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Just kind of recreated it.
Coming up.
You you became pretty good friends with Aerosmith, didn't you?
I kind of met those guys through dumb luck back at the Michigan Palace. My friends were working there, and, it just was Steve Glass production, and it was around 74. I think it was at the Allen Park Ice Arena. They had moved over to there by then. It was, I don't know if the Palace was available that time. Oh, they were rehearsing at the Palace for the gig out at in Allen Park. That's what it was. But they used the Palace to, maybe on the Thursday before the Saturday gig to get some of the cobwebs out.
Oh, sweet.
Detroit was always important. And that was a good year for them because they played there. And then the next time they came back, it was Friday the 13th of September, a day that I'll remember because the guy kind of rear-ended me on Adams Road, slight fender bender on the way to the gig. But Aerosmith headlined Pine Op, and that was like a real big deal.
In 74.
Yeah.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.
This is the history of WRIF, the podcast.
Riff rocks, baby.
You were music director for Riff in 1991.
Yeah.
And that's a very interesting and pivotal time.
It was
music.
Once again, just dumb luck, because the music was kind of changing again. This time it was kind of going a little bit away from hair bands. And which actually that was a really fun period when you think about it. And then the grunge stuff came out, much more of a darker feel. I remember talking to Joe Scroy, the owner over at the Ritz, and he would book a lot of these bands. And he goes, "Boy, I just don't like this new stuff. It's kind of dark. It's got a like a." I go, "Yeah, it does have a different feel." Whereas couple of years before, it was David Lee Roth, it was Crew going, sure. girls. Yeah. There was some really, and all those guys could play their butts off.
Yeah, you know? Big time.
I mean, a lot of those metal bands were, just really talented. You could get all over the guitar. That was the year of the pointy guitar. And,
But by the time 1992 got here and Smells Like Teen Spirit came out, it was 80, like the bands
it
were like,
played out.
Yeah, it played
Once
out.
Once Firehouse showed up, it was over.
Right, exactly.
That was it.
Trickster.
Yeah,
bands
you get
like
to the
that.
Point where you get those bands that are maybe third or fourth down on the tier from the really good ones that created it. And, you know, Guns N' Roses was king of the world. And they were great. I saw them a bunch of times because they got on that Aerosmith Permanent Vacation tour. And they were both on Geffen Records, so they dragged them out. So I saw when I go see Aerosmith outside of Detroit, we saw GNR, and they were definitely keeping that tradition going. And I thought for sure that they would just be the next Aerosmith, but they decided they did have an appetite for destruction now, didn't they?
Good one.
Yeah,
you became pretty good friends with Aerosmith, didn't you?
I kind of met those guys through dumb luck back at the Michigan Palace. You know, my friends were working there, and, it just was Steve Glatt's production, and it was around 74. I think it was at the Allen Park Ice Arena. They had moved over to there by then. It was, I don't know if the Palace was available that time. Oh, they were rehearsing at the Palace for the gig out at in Allen Park. That's what it was. But they used the Palace to, maybe on the Thursday before the Saturday gig to get some of the cobwebs out.
Oh, sweet.
Detroit was always important. And that was a good year for them because they played there. And then the next time they came back, it was Friday the 13th of September, a day that I'll remember because the guy kind of rear-ended me on Adams Road, slight fender bender on the way to the gig. But Aerosmith headlined Pine Op, and that was like a real big deal.
In 74.
Yeah. So, that was when the second album was out, and Train Kept a Rollin' and Same Old Song and Dance and Lord of the Thighs and
great album.
Spaced and Seasons of Wither and the whole deal. So that was a big deal there, the September 13th. And then they went away, and then they came back the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, and they headlined Kobo.
Wow.
And headlining Kobo was the top of the pops then.
Right.
You either had to be one of the heroes of Woodstock or one of the big English bands or Grand Funk Railroad. That was about, Seeger wasn't playing Kobo back then.
Wow.
It was pre that. So, you had to be, he probably had. I think Ted may have even played Kobo like in 67. He was on some show when they had those like rock and roll reviews where each band would go up and pay about 20 minutes. I think he was on something where maybe even the Supremes might have even been on it or maybe in 68 because Journey to the Center of the Mind became a hit. Mm-hmm. I think that he had done some because, Ted was big early.
He was.
In a major way. So
and Ted and Aerosmith. It seems like they were on the same bill quite a bit.
They had similar management for a while, that Lieber Krebs. And stylistic, if you liked one, you liked the other one.
Oh, sure.
Because it was, Ted was a better guitar player than Joe or Brad at the time. And it had been for 5 years before those guys showed up. But, he was, really good an example of the irrational exuberance of Detroit stuff as well.
For sure.
But Journey to the Center of the Mind, just, feedback was real early, and he was a pioneer in that stuff.
Yeah, for sure. And I think he fed off a lot, too. Well, they were kind of coming up at the same time, the MC5, and that was just pure
And McCarty, he always talks about McCarty a lot, though.
Yeah,
he had seen McCarty in the Detroit Wheels days and, different places, and whenever I talk to him, he's always held Jim McCarty in real high esteem.
Yeah. You mentioned that you play guitar, and you've
sometimes
had a chance to play with a lot of people, though, right? Just happened to...
Well, none of the big platinum artists or anything, but a lot of the bar bands and stuff around. Yeah, I just started to get good at, tell me what couple songs we're going to do the day after tomorrow, and I'll go home and, if I get stuck somewhere, I'll call you. Where's that bridge? Oh, that's an... Okay, oh, that goes to the... Oh, I stay on that. Okay, good, I got it.
Yeah.
It's real key is to picking the songs you can handle. Now, do you play golf?
A little bit.
Okay. Well, a similar story. It would be like the following. You're playing a golf course, and that hole number eight, that thing always kicks my ass. I never do well on hole number eight, you know. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to skip number eight and I'm going to play number nine twice. You know, so, you know, basically what you do in music is you find the ones that are really in your wheelhouse. Yeah, it's right over the middle of the plate. And and it's key when you're not in a real band and you're just going up there and doing
that
stuff.
Read, though, that you played with Rob Tyner?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I did a benefit after Desert Storm. And it was for the troops. We did it over at the Ritz in Roseville.
Okay.
And I was getting all these guys. I put together just a, it was a loose jam. I just called all my friends, and because I had been doing the bar circuit like crazy back then, and we're doing this thing, and the money we raise is going to the USO, and blah 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 blah. And I called Rob Tyner up because he had come up on my show in 1988. It was the 20th anniversary of the recording of Kick Out the Jams. And he took over the show for like 2 hours. Sweet. We did all kinds of stuff, talked about the older stuff, played some of the newer stuff he had going on with that band that became Weapons. Mm. Joey Gatos and you know, Fred Schmidt and those guys. They've been in a few different, Muggsy, they'd been in several bands. So it was a pretty good unit that was backing him up. So Rob is like, Steve, I'd be honored to blah, 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 support the troops. I'm getting all excited. You know, he's almost coming through the phone as I'm talking to him. Kind of like Nugent does that, too. You know, it kinda, you get kind of swept up in it. Mm-hmm. And so he came out, and it was really just a loose jam. It's like, well, what are we going to do? And he goes, well, how about, like, you know, Motor City's Burning and Back in the USA. And I said, okay, Motor City's Burning. And it was Robert Gillespie, Bruce Meakin, who's played in Flash Cahan and several other bands, and now he thinks he's in Planet of Fun forever.
Yeah.
And Gillespie and, you know, the two pros and me. And but I'm in charge. So it's good to be the king.
Nice.
So Bruce goes, you know, I'll play bass, Steve. You just go ahead and whatever. Because bass players, you have to kind of show up. You know, you have to be pretty steady.
Yeah, you do.
And that ain't me. like Tom Hamilton once said, he goes, bass playing is like hotel housekeeping. You only notice it when it's done poorly.
Right.
You know? So,
that's funny. That's
so I said, I can probably bluff the leads. It's in the key of E for Motor City's Burning, right? And the other one is like kind of a Chuck Berry standard thing, too. So, it was Gillespie and I on guitar, and Tyner Swung. Nice. was singing. And while he's singing, you know how when a bat goes by at dusk, you see that little, like, flash of a phantom?
Sure.
I'm up there playing, and the lights are on. And it's, something kind of goes by, and I'm done. And then it happens again. I forgot, and this guy's like, swinging that, like a mace, that weapon, going the Rob Tyner meets Roger Daltrey sway. And, you know, and so it was like, note to self, you know.
Step back.
Yeah, just buy him where you are, because there's incoming with this guy. It was cool as heck, but it was kind of a fun moment, you know.
Right.
And it was really funny, because I played, like, way over my head. It was just one of those, you know, looks like a stroll light night, you know. Like, Ray Euler was a typical really bad Detroit Tiger in 68 series. In fact, they sat him down because he had like a 187 batting average, and they had to shuffle the whole lineup around. But it'd be like if I was Ray Euler and I went, you know, 3-for-4 with a home run and a double and 4 RBIs or something that day. It was just one of those. I was so excited to be playing with him. I got all over it. I had my own axe, which really makes a huge difference,
right,
too.
You know, I'm always amazed by you, Steve. Your memory, you remember details, dates.
Well, some of that stuff's pretty vivid, you know, at the time, but, you know, I think it maybe has to do with being young. I don't remember as much of the stuff recently, but I haven't been out doing that crazy stuff like I used to all the time either.
Right.
But, you know, some of that stuff was pretty noteworthy, and Rob passed away about 6 months after that. And there is, somebody had a cassette somewhere, and it's very poorly recorded. I don't know how they did, but it's definitely us doing that song, because I only had about 3 or 4 really pet like speed licks, maybe 2.5.
Right.
So I recognized that one. It's like, oh yeah, guys, I always go to that one. I was one I could play real fast, and you know, it looks good. But if you get like into the 3rd or 4th song, you know, you're
right.
Getting into recycling, you know.
Right.
But you know, it looks good when you hit them with it quick, and then you know when to get off the stage.
You changed subjects a little bit. You had a great show on the Riff called Sonic Rendezvous.
Yeah,
talk about that.
Well, that was the one that Rob came up on as well, Tyner. But I started at ABX on Sunday nights. What happened was it was called Dangerous Exposure. Mm. And what happened was when we changed program directors, we had a lot of this new cutting-edge stuff sprinkled in throughout the broadcast day, normal rotation. We weren't getting credit for it. There was like this group, Free Radio Now, and you guys know, you know, we play that, some band that they liked, and then play like Journey or something. So it wasn't like really a landing with the listeners. It hadn't, you know, it wasn't sticking. So the new program director wanted to get rid of a lot of that stuff anyways. I said, tell you what, why don't we just put it where they can find it every Sunday night, 8 to 10. Then you can just tune in and boom, you're going to find nothing but that there.
Yeah, great idea.
And, you know, some of these ones that are a little too ahead of their time to be on regular rotation at the radio station, you know, you can even tell the labels, hey, we're playing it on this Sunday night thing.
And what are some of the bands that might be in that level at that time?
Let's see. Anything from the Joe Perry Project to a lot of the Wave stuff that was coming out. Mostly it was a lot of the stuff that was coming out on MTV and, you know, the early, that whole change in music. And they really, in Detroit wasn't, I don't know if it's, they weren't quite as up to, we weren't quite like where LA was when it came to that kind of stuff. You know, we were more of our rock and, you know, we want our meat rock and roll.
Yeah, big guitars.
And, so that was a good place for a lot of that stuff. You know, you could put it on a lot of the early MT. Like, you know, we had that Lost 80s Live show at OMC. We've had a couple of years. It'd be a lot of bands in that genre. Of course, all things Bowie, Stooges. You know, I still was able to lay on and lean on all the Detroit stuff, though, just because it was kind of a, you know, a place for that stuff.
Yeah.
So I didn't, it wasn't really like a totally new wave show because it was the Steve Costan Detroit getting away with it interpretation of that.
Right.
Somewhat.
Tell me about your relationship with Bob Seger.
I don't know Bob that well. By the time I got into radio, he had already done Live Bullet, and then he became like, you know, super huge. The, guys like Calvert Johnson, Savelli, and Penhall, I got to know him a little bit better. But I've had many encounters with him over the years, you know, socially and, you know, not just at his concerts and other things. And he's always been, like, great. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, he's kind of... Dennis Frawley told me something when I first started at ABX. He said, because we used to do those, like, in-store appearances with artists sometimes, like at Peaches Records or something, or Harmony House. Come out and meet so-and-so, and he'll sign you, you know, buy his new album, he'll sign it for you. That kind of, it was regularly done, you know, because we were all young and, you know, selling records and stuff. And Dennis told me, he said, you know, Bob doesn't really enjoy these things that much, you know. He gets a little uncomfortable, you know, doing the accolades and stuff. And he goes, on the other hand, Ted can't live without it. And I said, well, that's okay. You need both kinds, you know, and you know, most
both kinds.
Rock stars probably would be like Ted or you know, or Mick or Iggy or David Lee Roth or something. I mean, you know, and you got to have that aspect, you know, that performance gene. But, you know, Bob was never really like heavy in that, but he was such a good songwriter and, you know, a little more of an introspective guy. But, I mean, I've chatted him up for hours. I mean, I remember one of the Penhall weddings. I think it was number 14. I'm not sure, but you know, we ended up hanging out for a couple hours as it got late, and then things got a little looser, and other things. We had some mutual friends, so we'd end up at some parties together. Yeah. And he was always a great guy.
Yeah. Who are some of your favorite interviews? You've interviewed a lot of people.
Yeah, yeah. Let me think. One of my best ones was that I was really proud of was Bowie.
What year?
It was around 90-ish. He was playing at the Palace, I think, or he was, yeah, he had to be playing at the Palace. I don't think he ever did DTE or Pine Ave. And it was supposed to be on Arthur's show at around about 5:30. And it was getting kind of late, and he hadn't gone on. And Art wasn't as big a Bowie fan as I was anyways. You know, if it had been, I don't know, the Jefferson Airplane or something, he would have probably been better suited for. So it ran late, and I ended up being on the radio. It was after 6 o'clock. Mm-hmm. As it got close to six, I can't remember what the PD was. Go, why don't you go in there and help and do it with Arthur? You know, then Arthur just checked. I don't want to do it anyway. I'm off there. I'm going home. So it was great. So I got him, and it was live on the telephone. You know, back in those days, and it was 15 minutes long,
which is a long
afternoon drive. Pretty much, it was like, I don't know, 10 after 6 till about 625 or whatever the heck it was. But it was pretty cool because, you know, I started off talking a little bit about them, seeing them in Masonic when the first tour came. And it, you know, and then all of a sudden you must have found a quarter on the street because all of a sudden you have these big costumes and all this stuff the next time around. Oh, yes, that you saw that thing. That was a Japanese designer. So-and-so did that outfit for me. So we kind of knew that, okay, this guy is actually a little familiar with some of my work, which is kind of neat. We got into all kinds of stuff. We talked about Stevie Ray Vaughan because Stevie Ray Vaughan was in town the same night. I think he was playing with
Royal Oak Music Theater,
perhaps, or yeah, he may have been something. But oh, that's fantastic! Yeah, he's actually at a different venue this evening. We got into that, and then we got into the whole Soupy Sales, because you know, with the Detroit connection, because Hunt and Tony Sales had done some stuff with. You know, David Bowie with his, that other project, was that Tin Machine, I think it was called?
Yeah.
So, I mean, somehow I was able to worm that in there.
Great memory.
And then I also, so you're playing at the Palace, the home of the world champion Detroit Pistons. Mm-hmm. Oh, great. You know, so, I mean, I really was pleased being just live on the radio. I didn't have notes or anything, but I just, I was so anxious to talk to the guy that I had no problem having stuff to talk to
him
about.
And you're familiar. Totally familiar.
Yeah, it was real easy. It'd just be like sitting down, hey, what about that?
Right.
And that's, if you go to my SoundCloud page, you'll find one interview up there because I put it up the day he passed away. And that took me like 3 hours to figure out how to do that. But so that's the only one up there. But I had a really good one with Robert Plant. I had a couple with Roger Daltrey, Ringo, Ronnie Wood, all the Aerosmith guys a bunch of times. Ted and Peter Wolf back-to-back one New Year's Eve when they were Wolf was playing the Ritz and Ted was doing the Whiplash.
Yeah.
I was filling in for Arthur because he never worked the holidays. Mm-hmm. So I had him like a half hour apart, and that was just pure radio adrenaline.
Right.
I was like, get off the phone with this guy. I got on an hour, and I got that big show at the Ritz happening tonight with Wolf, and now joining me on here's so that was real cool. They can be really good. It's a lot of fun, you know.
It is.
Brian Ferry from Roxy Music. You know, I'm probably forgetting most of them, but
what bands did you have come in the studio and jam?
Well, let's see. Not directly jamming on my show, but when I got off, we did Rockline from Riff 1 year and Stevie Ray Vaughan.
Wow.
And Mike Mayer's in a panic, our program director. He needs to have a certain kind of a guitar amplifier, and I'm calling these music stores, and I said, hold on a sec, Mike. So let me call Randy Vaughan. You know, because what he wanted was more of an authentic tubes, you know, tube-powered kind of blues amp. And I said, I'm sure Randy's got it. And so
you found it.
And Randy, you know, I said, I got one, but, you know, here's my stipulation. I get to come over while you're doing the show, and I'll bring my amp over, and I get to sit, you know, in riff, you know, while that's going on, meet the guy. Blah, blah. Hey, no problem. Come on over.
Coming up.
In 2011, you had an awesome honor to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
That just blew your mind.
It did. Actually, they called me. I got some email at the station I was at the time, and it was some guy, I can't remember his name, but he had like an Italian last name. My name is so-and-so. You may have heard. I used to work for Album Network. I'm currently helping the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame put together some stuff. They're going to update their, you know, rock on the radio kind of thing and add some jocks. You have been just, excuse me, baking powder? You have blah, 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 blah. And so I was like, oh, this is kind of cool. Is this legitimate or anything? So I had a couple of friends. And they both kind of knew Kramer a little bit, so they kind of checked him out. And a few days later, he came back, and Howard and Leslie goes, yeah, it's happening. He goes, I just want you to know, you know, because I knew you before you got into radio. I never thought you'd make it.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.
Yeah. This is the History of 101 WRIF, the podcast.
All right, this is 101 FM WRIF, Detroit's home of rock and roll. If I press a couple of buttons here, joining me on the line should be...
Hi.
It is. It's David Bowie.
Good early evening, Steve. How are you?
Legendary personalities from Detroit's iconic WRIF.
And then you had the Let's Dance album, and you found some guy under a rock down in Texas.
Yeah, Stevie Ray Vaughan.
Uh-huh.
Actually, I found him high up on a rock in Switzerland. Is actually where I found him.
Is that right?
He was playing one night down at a jazz club, jazz and blues club in Montreux in Switzerland, and I was fortunate enough to be there. I thought, gee, this kid is a whiz. This kid is great.
With Mike Staff and our special guest, Steve Costan.
He will be in town this weekend as well.
Is he really?
With Joe Cocker at Pine Knot.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So it's all kind of happening here all at once there.
Are we there at exactly the same time, I wonder?
Yeah, you're Friday, Sunday, and Monday.
Oh,
and,
dynamite.
And on your off day, he's playing with Joe Cocker.
Oh, that is brilliant. That's fantastic.
The History of WRAF podcast is brought to you by the Specs Howard School of Media Arts.
Do you have tapes of most of your interviews?
Probably more than half.
Wow, that's great. That's
you know, you
really
just remember
good.
To pop that little cassette yep. in there where we had the skimmer. And I'm just trying to think if there was any other... the musical performance thing isn't coming to me right away.
Okay.
So, but I've had some other people.
Have you had some bad interviews that kind of went south?
I had one that was just... really just made me feel uncomfortable.
Really?
Yeah.
Do tell.
now he's no longer with us, but I mean, since that happens, unfortunately, to a lot of our artists nowadays,
sure.
Lou Reed. Mm. Lou Reed comes in. I'm excited because I knew the Velvet Underground stuff from about 71, 70, and but now this is 1980, and now that's like... To him, it's like long gone. It was like when I was interviewing Plant. They said, "Don't ask him about Zeppelin." Mm. It was similar to that, but they didn't give me the "Don't ask him about rules" before the interview. So I started dwelling a little bit too much on the past, and he wanted to push his current album, which I think was called Street Hassle, and he became a little. You could tell he was being irritated, and then the straw that broke the camel's back. Which we were talking about Mitch Ryder, and he said, you know, Mitch Ryder did a great version of Rock and Roll, you know, my song. We really love that version. I said, Mitch has got a new album out, you know, there's a song called War. Would you like to hear it? And he's like, yeah. So this is all live in the radio. So I put the thing up on, you know, I cue it up and it's playing. It's about a 7-minute song. About 90 seconds into it, he goes, this is terrible. You know, off mic, of course.
Oh.
You know, how long is this? Oh, yeah, well, it's 7 minutes. Take it off. I said, what? You know, take it off. It's like, I really can't. A couple of years before, we had a mutual friend who lived down on Orchard Lake and who knew Mitch Ryder. And the only time I ever got up on water skis, he was in the boat. Mitch was in the boat. He was out hanging with my friend Larry. And so I kind of knew him through other people and stuff. And plus, it's Detroit and it's Mitch Ryder.
Right,
like,
you don't do that.
It's like, look, I'm not going to do it. And he was surprised. I just held the line.
Wow.
I made him sit through the whole thing.
So you nervously kind of chit-chatted with him for 7 minutes?
And then after
minutes?
That, it was just like one-word answers. We wrapped it up, and he was a little ticked off. And I was just, you know, kind of sweaty. You get that feeling around there. And then later he had said something to the record person, Steve Costan's Time Machine of Rock and Roll or something, because I hadn't, you know, I wasn't pushing the other one. And that one was very uncomfortable, and I was kind of bummed out because I really enjoyed his work, but that was not a very positive radio experience.
Right. In 2011, you had an awesome honor to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah, yeah.
That just blew your mind.
It did. Actually, they called me. I got some email at the station I was at the time, and it was some guy, I can't remember his name, but he had like an Italian last name. My name is so-and-so. You may have heard. I used to work for Album Network. I'm currently helping the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame put together some stuff. They're going to update their, you know, rock on the radio kind of thing and add some jocks. You have been, excuse me, baking powder? You have blah, 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 blah. And so I was like, oh, this is kind of cool. Is this legitimate or anything? So I had a couple of friends that I thought might be able to help me out. Gary Graff, because he was familiar with Howard Kramer, was the guy who was... who made the choice. And I guess he knew him because Howard was originally from Southfield or something.
Oh, he was the curator of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah, back then. And I asked him and I asked Howard Lesnick, and they both kind of knew Kramer a little bit, so they kind of checked him out. And a few days later, he came back, and Howard and Lesnick goes, yeah, it's happening. He goes, I just want you to know, you know, because I knew you before you got into radio. I never thought you'd make it. Gee, thanks a lot, Howard. I appreciate it. At least you're still consistent, you know.
Thanks for your support.
All the way through, yeah.
So yeah. I'm sure you've been down there and you've seen it.
Well, they told me you can't tell anybody. Because we're remodeling the whole place. We're going to move the radio thing from the fourth upstairs down to the thing. We're really, really, you know, revamping. It's time for a refresh for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So it's going to take a little while. Well, a few months. It took like about 6 months for them to do it.
Wow.
So I'm just kind of biting my tongue the whole time, knowing that I'm getting in and really trying to and honoring the fact that I'm not going to blab it just because I don't want to blow it.
Right.
And
that's motivation.
Then the next fun phase, which was kind of fun, was, okay, we need an audio clip because basically what you do is you go in, there's a kiosk and there's four kiosks. And then you hit the, there's a map of the United States, and you hit the Midwest, then Detroit, then pick a decade, and then here's the names across there, and you push on the name, then my bio will come up, and then there's headphones, and you can listen to, you know, your career boiled down into 3 minutes. So he said, you know, 2.5 to 3 minutes. Here's the typical, you know, research speak. We find that the average, you know, person gets bored after about 2.5 to 3 minutes. So limit your tape to that. What if I'm talking to David Bowie and Robert Plant? You know,
right.
I mean, so I set him on in. It was about 7-some minutes long, rejected, sent back. You know, it was via email, so it wasn't like I had to like rap and go through.
Right.
So then I cut it down to about 5. No, you know, came back again. Darn, you know, because I had a couple of them in there. So I cut it back to, and so it eventually, you know, it boiled down to that. But one thing I'm really proud of is I used this thing from CSX to start it off because that's where I was at the time. And I had this feature called Michigan Mondays, you know, using the Bob Ufer pronunciation, Michigan instead of Michigan.
Right.
But I started off with, okay, we're going to start off Michigan Monday, blah, 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 blah. This, that. And here's the guy, let's face it, they didn't sell a ton of tickets. They didn't sell a ton of albums. But, hey, he saved a fortune on shirts. Bowang, wow, wow. Iggy and the Stooges on da-da-da-da on WCSX. That was always, and that kicks it off. So that
nice.
Was, I'm glad I did that. You know, I'm glad I never took myself too seriously.
Right.
It's got to be a serious interview. You know, I might be interviewing the, you know, Lieutenant Governor of the state of Michigan next. It was like, nah, I've always kept the rock and roll thing.
And, right. Rock and roll,
you know,
is not serious.
If I'm unsuited for that stuff, so be it. You know, I knew that when I was 12.
What do you suppose it is about Detroit that
made it so what it was?
Yeah.
Well,
from a rock perspective.
Rob Tyner really credits a lot of the Motown. And he says, you know, just the, he goes, you know, the fact that these guys showed up with a show made us all, me and all my peers, they really showed us how it can be done. You know, you go up there and give a performance, not just sit around and just play.
Yeah.
And like a friend of mine who said he went and saw the Steely Dan guys about 12 years ago or something. He said the band comes out and plays, you know, a little bit before, and then they come walking out. But I can't remember which one of the, if it was Becker or Fagan. He came walking out dressed like the guy that shows up at your office to fix the Xerox machine. He goes, you know, for crying out loud, you know, like go buy a pair of smart trousers or,
right.
or at least some kind of cool shirt,
right,
you
right.
know, make it, you know. So they really were impressed by that whole high level of energy and professionalism and visual that the Motown provided because they had a little bit of that choreography going. And then, you know, MC5 and all of our really favorite bands really exemplified, you know, putting on the show, part of the show.
They did, yeah, for sure. What is it about Riff, you think, that resonated with Detroit?
Well, they had competition, so it wasn't like they completely owned it all the time. There was, you know, ABX and W4 were playing stuff a little bit ahead of Riff. Riff was kind of like the big popular. If it did well on those stations, a couple weeks later, Riff would play it.
Mm-hmm.
But, boy, they always had the high ground, I guess you could call it. or the inside track, the high ground, the advantage. They had that monster signal that was far superior to the other two stations. And with ABC owned and operated, they were always able to really dig deep promotionally and keep the station out front. They were quite successful. They had like four or five different stations around the country, ABC did. We're all kind of in that thing, and they were considered like the Clipper class, the upper echelon nationally. Just the company itself was, they really played to win, and they really believed in investing the talent. Look what happened. You know, they assembled that dream team at Riff around 79 to 81.
Yep.
I say 81 because that was like the last piece that was needed. After Wheels shut up, they needed one more. But, you know, they got us, these people from different stations, put them all together. At the same time, across the driveway, Channel 7 was doing the same thing. They got John Kelly and Marilyn Turner from Channel 2. They got so-and-so from 4. And they had the thing, we got the people you wanted. They
assembled. The cream of the crop. Yeah,
so that was a company philosophy that, that, you know, we're going to really invest in the top talent. And it worked.
It did work.
Yeah.
It worked big time. Any other great stories about Riff, time at Riff?
There was a lot of great stories and a lot of great times. Let me think if there's, even doing one of the most fun things I did was not really rock and roll. I was still at Riff was when I got to drive in the celebrity races the Detroit Grand Prix. You know, just because when do you get to do that? And, you know, not get in trouble. And they, you know, sent me to some racing school out in Connecticut. Lime Rock was the name of the track, Skip Barber. And we did that. And then, you know, you get kind of like, you know, good enough for that. And there was Eric Smith from Channel 7 was in it. And Frank Beard from ZZ Top was in it that first year.
Nice.
Because ZZ was playing two shows at the Palace. I don't know when the guy slept, but
I remember that.
And a buddy of mine was drum teching for him. So we got to know Frank a little bit and went out and saw the Sunday show. But just the whole thing about being able to hang out with those guys, and that was still when Mario Andretti was the Arrivederci Mario tour in 94. It was his last season, and Paul Newman's riding by on a little moped, and it was just a backstage glimpse into something that I had never really seen before. And music wasn't boring or anything like that, but it was just neat to look at. I mean, it was race cars, and it's Detroit.
Right.
You know, all of a sudden, I'm putting on the helmet, and I'm walking around with a racing suit on.
That's
and
cool.
Getting interviewed by Drew and Mike, you know, and I was on the station. And then Emerson Fittipaldi and Dennis Archer were in the pace car, and we're driving around following them. Get ready to start. I can't believe I'm doing this. the stuff. It was great.
That's
awesome. So that was one highlight moment. And another one was getting on the stage at the Silverdome a couple minutes before Van Halen went on for the Monsters of Rock.
Wow.
That was
and just
you know, the feel and the power. Yo, you know, I mean, you've been on stage. You know, I mean, you sound big when you're at the Ritz or at Harpo's.
Right.
And, of course, if you get on to somewhere bigger, I mean, I was just out at Shane Park the other night. It was great bringing those bands on with, you know, feeling that microphone. But, I mean, to do it at the Silverdome, that was insane.
Well, and the weird thing about the Silverdome is, like, you could say, what's up, Detroit? But it takes a minute to get to them.
Yeah.
And then for their roar to come back, and you're like, is this thing on?
Yeah, you got to be a little deliberate when it comes to that kind of stuff and keep it simple.
Yeah.
You know, you can't get really conversational on something like that. It's
right,
like,
that's for sure.
But I just remember being there and I'd been on a lot of stages, and, you know, a lot of times you can't see well out into the crowd because of the lights.
Right.
But at that one, it seemed like the crowd was out somewhere across the Grand Canyon to me. I mean, that stage went way out, and then there was just the void out there.
Yeah, that's awesome.
It was cool, and we had dropped off contest winners early that day. It was an all-day thing, and that new band, Kingdom Come, was just playing. And so we wanted to see Kingdom Come for sure, but it was going to be like about a 90-degree sunny day. So Scott Brown, our promotions director, and I, you know, we took the listeners out there with a bus, but then we had an arrangement where we got a car and we went over to Dan and Kathy's house on Pontiac Lake and cranked beers on the boat all afternoon. Then kind of showered up and you know, got a second wind for the evening and came back and finished it off at Monsters of Rock.
That's a great day.
It was awesome. It was in 1988.
You had mentioned Drew and Mike. You were at Riff before Drew and Mike and during the explosion of Drew and Mike. like, of course, it was Drew and Zip.
Yeah.
What did you think of the Drew and Zip show when they first got to Riff?
Well, see, this is a strange deal because when they came in, we had just lost Ken Calvert to Wheels. And the salespeople were walking around going, this is the end of the world, oh my God, you know, et cetera. And I was going, well, you know, that's water under the bridge now. This is our new this is our quarterback now. We got to get behind this guy. So I hit it off pretty well with Drew. And I think he probably could have, he needed like to have a couple of friends around
at the time. Because he didn't know anyone in Detroit.
Yeah, and everyone's going, oh man, we are screwed now. Who is it, you know? And so, yeah, we went golfing. We did some stuff. I had him over to my house for a few parties and things. And they were pretty good. The Zip guy was pretty decent. But he was going through some marital problems, and he kind of like just kind of lost focus, and it didn't work out. And then Mike Clark kind of slid
right
in
time.
There. Yeah, yeah. Answer me.
Right.
And that thing just took
yeah, off.
Yeah,
and I do
those
think,
talent guys, I mean, he kind of filled the gap that George was kind of doing, the buyer. I mean, he had the ability to bring that creative side, and then you have the semi-straight man, the jock that's kind of really holding the whole thing together.
Right.
But, you know, you have the...
You know, I give Doug Podell a lot of credit on that, too, because Drew had to play like four or five records an hour. And Doug came in and said, hey, man, just be you. Do you. Don't worry about playing the music. And that's, cool. I think, it kind of opened up a little bit for him.
Yeah, but they had already been kicking morning butt. They broke through in early 94. That's when they passed JJ and the morning crew. I was still a Riff, and all of a sudden we were knocking off that legendary morning show.
For sure.
And that was really cool.
It was. It was a really cool
time. I mean, I love the Jim and George, but, you know, they're on the other team now. And even if Magic Johnson and Isaiah Thomas used to go hang out after the game, during the game, you know, if he's dribbling by, I'm going to try and slap that ball away.
Of course.
The name of the game.
Right, the home team.
Yeah.
Steve, you're awesome. I really appreciate it. I got to say, you are the real deal. You are truly a rock fan, for sure, but you know the music. You love the music. You're such a Detroit boy. I mean, you just personify cool rock radio DJ. So,
well, I hope people around here like it because there's no way I'm going anywhere else. You know, if I go somewhere else, it'll be not to do radio. You know,
well,
I mean, this is where I belong.
It is.
It's where I, you know, started, you know, everything, you know. I started out as a child, as one comedian once said on one of his albums, and it's just been the place to be. And I've had a couple opportunities. There's a couple of New York things, one San Diego, and I'm just glad that I stayed here.
Well, me too. Yeah, me too.
Definitely.
42 plus years.
Yeah, I mean, going back a ways, and it's just been a great place to be a rock DJ. I mean, if you want to be a rock and roll DJ and you like the heavier guitar stuff, which I always have, I thought that was the essence of rock.
No question.
So this is the place to be, Detroit, Rock City, baby.
Yeah, Detroit, Rock City. Thank you, Kid Costan.
That was fun.
Steve Costan, thanks, buddy.
Next time.
The best call letters in rock radio. In fact, I heard Howard Stern talking recently about there are no better call letters for a rock station than the Riff, WRIF.
And he's right.
He is right.
And you know who thought they were dumb?
Who? You did?
I said, WRIF? Are you serious?
Legendary personalities from Detroit's iconic WRIF. With Mike Staff and our special guest, former program director Dick Kernan.
Did you put together the Riff, the whole Riff thing? Or,
no.
No, you weren't even thinking it.
I don't deserve the credit for any of that.
That is
funny.
But
it was really funny because we were owned by ABC. And so we had some money, honey. Mm-hmm. So WAVX, see you, bye. Don't let the door hit you.
Uh-huh.
So we, you know, just came on with the new set of call letters, and which turned out to be great, which, because I'm a genius, I thought, those are the dumbest call letters I've ever.
The History of WRAF podcast is brought to you by the Specs Howard School of Media Arts.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music.
Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.